The Hatteras was a big target. Not only was it white, or once white, and two stories high, it threw a big bow wave. Even though they were running with the sun at their backs, Ryan knew they could be seen from a long way off. As the dark island grew even larger, he glanced at Chucho, who was standing near where the Mattachine commander had been tied up for the entire 9-hour trip.
Someone could be waiting for us on the beach.
Casacampo looked up at Ryan, clearly uncomfortable.
No one will be watching in the heat of the day. Besides, boats come and go from the island all the time, bringing in supplies. No one pays much attention.
Just in case, maybe we better break out the RPDs to handle any beach crowd.
There is more than one landing place. On the north side of the island, there is a rocky point with caves at the foot of the cliffs. You can follow them up into the rainforest, keep out of sight the whole time.
What about the ship?
There is a cove, a natural harbor with a lava breakwater. The Hatteras should make it over the bar. He's been in there before. Inside the protected cove is plenty deep.
Chucho, you think it's bullshit?
He's too scared to lie to us. If he's looking to make his move, it wouldn't be something this easy to see through.
All right, then. Let's try it.
The north side of the island was in the wind's lee, and because of that, it was a good 10 degrees hotter. The coastline along the point was made up of cliffs of volcanic rock. They looked like piles of giant ossified black turds, segmented, some with twisty-twirly tops. The walls of lava soaked up the sun's heat and radiated it back like a bake oven. Tom negotiated the passage between the tip of the natural breakwater and the head of land. Inside the cove, the water was pale turquoise and very clear. Ryan could see the white sandy bottom 50 feet down. Casacampo eyed the waters with something like longing.
Sometimes escaped prisoners get this far. They try to swim or raft across the water to the mainland. There are huge sharks waiting for them. The prison guards watch from cliffs with binoculars and make bets on which convict the sharks will eat first.
You need a fucking new hobby.
Tom and Ryan waded from the dinghy to the shore, carrying 25 pounds of C4 each in pre-rigged 1-pound chunks, plus two loaded RPDs and a pair of H&K MP5 SD1s and machetes. Chucho followed, carrying a silent submachine gun, a backpack with extra drum mags for the Soviet machine guns, and a machete. Casacampo slogged onto the beach with all their canteens over his shoulder and his hands tied in front of him. When he got to land, Chucho hooked a leash around his neck.
Can't let you get lost!
At the foot of the cliff, white sand met black rock. There was more than one cave entrance. It was impossible to tell which were dead-end tunnels. Ryan looked at Casacampo.
Which one is it?
The Mattachine pointed at a vertical gash in the bedrock. After putting on their headlamps, they entered the cave, which reeked of rotting seaweed and batshit. The sand floor quickly gave way to rock as the cavern upangled. Runoff from the forest above had cut the steep-sided crevice down to the sea. The confined space, the fact that they were using headlamps, would make for a prime ambush, Ryan knew. They'd never know what hit them.
Keep the pirate close, Chucho.
Definitely.
The four men climbed steadily up through the pitch darkness with silenced weapons at the ready. After a short distance, the cave widened into a low-ceilinged gallery and the floor angle flattened. There was a different odor, a carrion odor. Then Ryan's headlamp reflected in a pair of eyes, lots of eyes, low to the ground. Three headlamps swept over the crouching forms.
Nice doggies.
Yeah, right.
Ryan gripped his H&K. The dogs looked wet to the skin. They were big, rangy animals, 70 to 120 pounds. They were slathering mad. A particularly large specimen rose from its haunches and edged toward them, low to the floor, every muscle tensed. Behind it, a dozen pairs of red eyes followed. Ryan let the H&K fall to lanyard around his neck. He reached for the butt of the RPD and swung it around on its sling.
Looky there. We got one more and she's nursing her pups. They don't even have their eyes open yet. Maybe we're gonna have to deal with her on the way out. Maybe we should just chill them all now.
Go ahead. Be my guest.
Tom shook his head, making the light from his headlamp dance across the wall.
That bitch with puppies. That's bad juju.
They're feral dogs. Just leave them be. They can eat any amount of gene we don't manage to chill. There are many more. They run in much bigger packs than this. Pray they don't find us before we're done here.
Ryan walked past the carnage he'd created. The cave exit opened onto a jungle trail. It was very hot under the canopy and dark, but not dark enough to need the headlamps. Ryan elbowed Casacampo.
How far is it?
6 miles.
Shit. That's a waste of humping 100-degree heat and humidity.
Let's get to it.
The trail looked like it had been made by game. It was less than 3 feet wide and weaved back and forth around the bases of the massive trees. Ryan shoulder-slung the RPD and unsheathed his machete as he took point.
Too tight quarters for blasters.
Tom and Chucho slung their guns and unsheathed their blades as well. The Fer de Lance is a reddish-brown, white-and-black venomous snake. Its coloring makes it easy to hide in the litter on the rainforest floor. The one that reared up to strike Ryan was impossible to miss. It was more than 10 feet long, and its back was bigger across than his bicep. Ryan kicked the still-writhing body into the brush.
Shit! That's a big sucker!
Keep your eyes skinned. There could be more of those damn things.
To hike the 6 miles along the winding game trail, with all the ups and downs, the ravines to scale and the creeks to jump, with occasional water breaks to keep from getting too dehydrated, it took hours. They heard the hum of the generators long before they reached the prison's outer fence. Through the branches, they could see the bright clearing. Ryan pinned Casacampo with his icy stare.
Make one sound, and you die.
Casacampo nodded. He understood the price of betrayal. Understanding it and being willing to pay it were two different things. Ryan sensed the man's tension and guessed that he was considering the odds. If he could break free and alert his pals, he might get out alive and end up being a hero. Ryan wasn't going to let him do that. Under other circumstances, he would have chilled the bastard at once. Under these circumstances, there was still vital information to be had. They crawled forward to the edge of the jungle and gazed upon Jabalba, the mythical home of the all-powerful Lords of Death. Ryan thought that there wasn't much to recommend it. It looked like a shithole jungle prison. Double high-wire fence with guard towers around the inside perimeter. Mildewed, windowless concrete buildings on a roughly circular plain of dirt and scrub grass. People wandering around or stretched out in the shade.
Casacampo, where are my friends in that place? Which building are they being held in?
The Matachin pointed at the corner of a single-story structure that was just visible around the corner of the two-story cell block.
Probably that one. Razor House. He's where the white coats cut people up.
Tom raised a skeptical eyebrow and looked at Ryan.
Do you believe him?
If he lies, he dies. We won't make it to the inner wire if those two guard towers are still manned come sunset. We've got a clear overlapping kill zone between the two fences. We have to take them out nice and quiet so we can cut the wire and make our entry from the rear.
Getting through the wire was no problem because Tom had brought a pair of cutters in his pack. Getting out the same way might be more difficult, depending on how many enemy were still alive when the time came. The plan was to wait for the fading light of evening, snipe the tower gunners with the silenced SMGs, free the companions, chill as many Matachin and Lords of Death as they could, then blow the whole place to rubble and beat feet back to the ship. A tall order, Ryan knew. There were an uncounted number of ways the whole scheme could implode. Every step was a potential stumbling block or dead end. But there was no going back. Suddenly, the order got even taller.
Shit! It picked up our scent!
Ay, mi chacha!
The tall and lanky Dr. Monteo had the diminutive Bruja pressed up against the wall of the inoculation room, his hips driving while she clung around his neck, her legs wrapped around the small of his back. Both of them kept glancing over at Christy every few seconds to see if she was watching. If she was, they ratcheted up the frenzy of their running. Christy, who lay strapped to a crucifixion table, a captive audience of one, viewed the recreational in-out with disdain. She couldn't decide if they were indulging in celebratory sex or if this was their usual pastime come evening. It was, however, the first time she saw Dr. Monteo break a sweat.
Please. I hate to break it to you two, but you're not much to look at, and you're not that good at what you're up to.
The comment just made Monteo hump harder and faster, and the Bruja's eyes rolled up in her head so Christy could see only whites. After that, Christy decided to just ignore them. When they finally finished, the lab assistant pulled her bunched-up white coat skirt down over her somewhat wobbly, brown, bandy legs. She licked her finger, then used it to smooth her eyebrow. Very classy. Aside from Mildred, who was by all accounts a special case, the white coats Christy had seen had never impressed her all that much. This pair impressed her the least of any, and it wasn't just their lame sexual technique or penchant for exhibitionism. Their attire notwithstanding, they appeared to be dumb as frigging fence posts. While Christy watched, the doctor and his assistant began pulling on protective gear. They both donned latex gloves and some kind of heavy-duty antiviral masks with twin filtration canisters sticking out the sides of the mouthpiece. They also put on plastic goggles. From a countertop, Monteo picked up a clear plastic basin with a tight-fitting lid and carried it gingerly over to the rolling tray beside the crucifixion table. He opened the lid and took out a hypodermic syringe, moving in slow motion. The way he handled it, the thing might well have contained nitro. The fluid inside was the color of diluted blood, or strawberry juice, about 10 cc's. It was an uh-oh moment for Christy. Accordingly, her prehensile hair drew up in tight ringlets of alarm. For the 100th time, she tested the flex in her restraints. They didn't give so much as a millimeter. Even though her wrist and ankle manacles had been removed, she was pinioned to the table, all except her neck and head. She knew that the strawberry fluid had been taken from Daniel, that his filthy spew was about to be put inside her, and there was nothing she could do about it. It was as bad as rape, maybe even worse because of what it was going to do to her once it was inside her veins. Christy remembered all too well what the dying at Padre had looked like. People lying helpless in their own shit and piss and puke, waiting for the end. Could she be forced to be another Daniel? To become the knowing cause of something like that? Used to spread that kind of horror across the hellscape, leaving nothing behind but piles of corpses? She had no illusions on the subject. The spread of this disease, this plague, would end Deathlands, and the faint but lingering promise of a resurrected nation would be torn out by the roots. Where were the others? Were they already infected? How much serum from Daniel's bones was needed? Could they make enough of it to dose them all at once? Only Mildred would know the answers, and she wasn't here. Part of her was glad Ryan wasn't with her either. She was glad that he hadn't lived long enough to be put through this obscenity. She glared at the white coats.
You can give me the rad blasted disease, but you better pray it kills me. Because if I survive, I will be coming after you both. And what I will do to you, smirking, self-satisfied, murderous shithooks, you can't even begin to imagine.
The little Bruja smiled inanely.
There, there.
Monteo's bedside manner lacked even that subtlety.
Please be calm.
Christy could see the corners of his eyes crinkling in a smile, even through the goggles, as he put his free hand on her breast. She was about to call on her Gaia powers, hoping that the Earth Mother would grant her enough strength to not only break her bonds, but to chill these two wastes of breath, when blaster fire erupted from outside the building. Dr. Monteo hesitated, plague hypo in one hand, Christy's boob in the other.
Shit! They're almost here!
The howl seemed to be coming from three sides as the pack filtered through the jungle, closing in for the kill.
We can't wait for sundown. In another 5 minutes, the dogs will have us pinned against the fence. That will alert them out of Cheen, and then we'll be attacked front and rear, with no way out. Tom, cut the outside wire here. I'll take the tower gunner on the right. Chucho, you take the other one. Tom, get through the wire as quick as you can. Once the gun towers are dealt with, cross the no man's land and cut us a hole in the inside fence.
With the exception of your friends, of course. Everyone inside the compound has earned death. The so-called gods. They're pirate criminals. The white coats and dwarves who spread the plague, and the miscellaneous underlings and bootlicks that keep this place running. These creatures have sucked the blood of my people for decades. For that, they must pay. And they must never be allowed to rise up again.
We can't possibly kill them all. We can't cover all the ways out of here. Once we start shooting, they can scatter out the main gate or scale the fence and hightail it off into the jungle.
Let them. If the dogs don't run them down, they'll have nothing to come back to here. We'll make sure of that.
We will sink all their boats so they can't escape from this place. Let them try to swim to the mainland or make rafts from the trees. When the first few are eaten by sharks, there will be no more swimmers or rafters, I guarantee you. Once again, there will be prisoners for life on this hell island.
Casacampo stood as if to join them in the next phase of the operation.
Not you. You die here and now before you can betray us.
But... Shit. Ryan hurried away, concealed just inside the edge of the forest, moving parallel to the wire. When he arrived at a point outside the gun tower, he peered through the dense foliage. The Matachine in the tower wasn't looking his way. Under the shade of the tower's peaked metal roof, he had his back to the perimeter, and he was staring down at the goings-on inside the compound. Ryan crawled to the wire, then bellied down in front of it. He lined up the shot, bracing the silencer's fat barrel against the mesh. The distance was no more than 75 yards. He flipped the fire selector switch to tri-burst, snugged up the buttstock, and acquired the target. The man in the tower dropped out of sight behind the tower's front wall. Ryan scooted back to the forest. No longer concerned about being observed, he sprinted to the gaping cut in the wire. He got there just as Chucho arrived. Both towers were now unmanned. The way in was clear. The two men slipped through the break in the fence and crossed the stretch of open ground on a dead run. Tom was ahead of him, already kneeling at the second fence, working like a madman with the cutters. When they reached him, the traitor held open the hole he'd made so they could enter.
So far, so good.
Even though it was broad daylight, no one had noticed their penetration. Ryan knew that wouldn't last. The three of them cut across the swath of open ground toward the two-story cell blocks.
Oye!
Still, there was no armed response. Perhaps because this incursion into the heart of Xibalba was entirely unexpected and unprecedented. That all changed when four bald-headed pirates suddenly rounded the corner of the cell block, running with weapons up.
So much for surprise.
The Xibalban bystanders scattered as Ryan, Chucho, and Tom charged around the corner, headed for the rear of the Whitecoat building. They didn't have enough time or enough ammo to take out everyone in sight, just the combatants, the ones who stood in their way. Ryan hit the doors first. He burst into a foyer that opened onto a low-ceilinged reception area.
Christy! Mildred! JP! Doc! Jack! Where are you?
When there was no answer, he turned to Tom and Chucho.
All right, let's start kicking in some doors.
Ryan found Jack in the second room he tried. The albino was strapped and gagged on a table. Ryan immediately yanked out the gag and set to work on the straps.
Nuke, fucking slag-bait piece of shit, white coat!
He looked like a demon ghost. Ryan handed him the submachine gun and swung the big Russian MG around on its shoulder sling.
Fuck him up! Let's fuck him up!
Out in the hallway, Tom and Chucho had found and freed the others. When Christy saw Ryan, she ran toward him full tilt, threw herself into his open arms, and squeezed him tight, her emerald eyes shining with tears.
Oh, lover! Oh, Gaia, thank you! Thank you!
You are a sight for sore eyes, my dear Ryan.
Doc smiled hugely as Mildred stared bemusedly at Chucha.
And we're seeing double.
Explanations later. Escaping now.
Harmonica Tom opened Ryan's backpack, reached in, and took out a pre-rigged block of C4.
Where is this going to do the most damage?
The quarantine section down the hall behind you. That's where they keep the Inanos and the Plague Serum. It's a triple layer of containment, pressure sealed so the disease can't accidentally get out. Once that's gone, they'll never be able to rebuild it or make more plague carriers.
If we blow it up, won't we be releasing it?
The heat of the explosion will probably destroy it.
And even if it doesn't, it'll be contained on the island. We're 50 miles from the mainland. When we leave, we're turning the lights out.
Ryan took Tom's HMK and handed it to JB. There weren't enough extra weapons to go around. After Tom planted the charge, Ryan waved them to the door.
Now, let's go pay a visit to the Lords of Death.
They're probably all holed up in the gym building. It's their council place. It's where they hold audiences with their toadies. They've got big time backup in there.
As they exited the research center, bullets slammed into the concrete facade and skipped off the concrete walkway. They were moving too quickly to see where the blaster fire was coming from, and it didn't matter at that point. Their goal was to reach the next bit of solid cover, which was the near wall of the gymnasium. They ran past assorted sniveling wretches and pus bags, who, although still smiling to beat the band, were wandering around in a daze, not understanding what had happened or what was about to happen. When the companions fetched up against the wall of the gym, Ryan glanced at Mildred.
Doors in, doors out.
Two doors, one at either end. There are no other ways out.
They're in there. We've got them.
Ryan sent Jack off to the right with extra mags for the H&K to cover the gym's rear exit and forestall a retreat in that direction. Then he and the others ran for the building's main entrance. As they came around the corner, they took fire from the gun tower opposite.
Kick in the doors!
Behind them, as Chucho and Tom approached the gym's entrance, a fusillade of blaster fire roared from within. The rain of outgoing slugs rattled the gym doors in their frame. Ryan moved closer to the building's front wall, out of the path of the ricochets.
Chucho, let's give him something to think about.
Tom stepped away from the wall and swung his RPD up from the hip. Chucho jumped to his side. Teeth bared, muscular arms shuddering from the sustained buffeting of recoil, they moved to the left as they shot, edging into the kill zone, sweeping the interior of the gym with a withering counterfire of 700 steel-jacketed rounds per minute. There was no return fire. Ryan and JB burst through the doorway with their auto-weapons at hip level. Wreaths of gun smoke hung over the middle of the court. The floor between the old free-throw lines was littered with bodies and blood. The Shabalba hangers-on and minor demons had taken the brunt of the exchange of firepower. Some of them still stirred, albeit feebly. It was impossible to tell which side had fired the bullets that cut them down. At the opposite end of the room, the exit door slammed back, and Bald Matachin put up scattered covering fire as they retreated. JB and Ryan fanned out, firing as they advanced. Ryan ran for the end of the bleachers. He could see the top two rows were occupied. Large figures in white robes with hideous head masks. But the spectators weren't moving, and they weren't armed. For the moment, they could be ignored. There were other fish to fry. Unmanacled for the first time in a month, and now fully armed, JB was all about getting payback. With interest. Fearless in his fury, JB charged the exit, spraying it with 9mm slugs. He took down three of the pirates before they could clear the doors. Ryan braced his RPD against the edge of a bleacher seat and punched out a stream of hot lead at the last three pirates who raced for the exit. Shooting erupted from outside the gym. The retreating Matachin had stumbled into Jack's ambush. The battle sounded one-sided. Because Lauren's weapon was silenced, only the pirate return fire could be heard. The pirates had either chilled Jack, or they were all dead. Knowing the albino teen as he did, Ryan was guessing it was the latter. He turned his attention and the sights of his weapon on the two rows of spectators above.
Get your hands up!
None of the seated figures moved a muscle.
Those are the lords of death.
Mildred, Doc, and Christy joined Ryan, Tom, and Chucho at the foot of the stands. Ryan did a quick head count. 30 of them. But there were holes in the ranks. 6 places were empty. JB eased in next to Ryan.
How come the masked assholes aren't moving? Are they already dead? Or are they stuffed?
We should check to see if any of them are real.
Yeah, I'll check them all right.
The white-robed torsos jerked, then toppled over. Garish masks rolled off headless shoulders and bounced down the tiers of bleacher seats to the court below. They were all dummies.
Nuke in hell, the bastards got away!
Jack poked his head through the back door.
Over here!
While Ryan, JB, Chucho, and Tom ran to join him, Doc, Mildred, and Christy took a moment to bend and pick up dropped submachine guns off the dead Matachin. Everybody had a blaster. Looking out the doorway, Ryan could see the bodies of half a dozen bushwhacked pirates caught by Jack's opening silenced burst.
Pin me quick. Couldn't nail all of them.
Jack pointed at the entrance to the cell block on the other side of a narrow courtyard.
You there, Ryan?
How many?
10, maybe more.
And the Lords of Death? Did you see them?
Already hightailing before camo fighters came out the back door. 5-6 motherfuckers in masks. They run fast. Ryan, I not see anyone run that fast.
They duck into the cell block too?
Nah, lit off a fence behind. Went through the hole.
Out into the jungle by now. Were they armed?
Nope. Empty hands.
Ryan, if they went out the way we came in, they'll run right into the wild dogs. That works for me.
Me too, Chucho. Me too. Tom, you gonna blow up the council place?
I don't know. Probably take most of the C4 to bring it down. But it rains a lot here, doesn't it?
Rains like holy hell.
Got enough extra C4 to blow out a supporting wall, bring down the roof.
Tom quickly removed a pair of charges from Ryan's backpack and placed them at the corners of the facing wall. He jogged back and rejoined Ryan and the others.
Let's finish this job.
Following Mildred out of the gym, Harmonica Tom had the rear guard on the file. Ryan took point as the group crossed the courtyard on a dead sprint, making for the cell block's doors. To their right was a low, windowless, shed-like building. A slug from overhead kicked up the dirt beside Jack's left boot. Not one of the companions flinched. However, the sniper on the cell block roof forced them to change course to the right, moving up against the maintenance shed and under the eaves of its sloping roof. As Tom was brushing past the shed's closed door, it jolted mightily in its frame.
The fuck is in there?
They've got a bunch of feral dogs trapped in there, and they use them to torture their subjects and to keep them in line. If you go in Jaguar House, you don't come out in one piece. You don't come out at all. The smell of blood and the sound of gunfire has really got the dogs worked up.
The group quickly moved in front of the cell block door.
We're gonna have to blow the door. It's locked from the inside.
No problem.
Tom unshouldered his backpack and from it took out a hunk of plastic already rigged with a blasting cap and a length of conventional fuse cord. He worked quickly, mashing the pliable explosive into the gap between the door hinges and frame. Then he lit the fuse with a wooden match. The others had spread out along the foot of the wall, kneeling with their heads turned toward the building. Tom joined in the duck and cover. The door frame was empty, but there were wide, branching cracks running up the side of the cell block's wall.
Maybe I used too much.
When Ryan led them inside, smoke was still pouring out the opening. The floor of the corridor was alive with small, flopping black things. Bats. Dying bats and already dead ones. When Tom entered last, there were still some of the leaping critters to kick aside. He looked down the central corridor. In the light of the electric bulbs, filtered through smoke, it was grim, gray, decaying. A different sort of prison than the ancient fort in Veracruz, more temporary, less eternal. Instead of an oppressively low stone ceiling, the cell block had a towering two-story height. But the stink of death and damnation was the same. There were four metal stairways at each corner of the narrow rectangle, each leading up to the second tier of cells and a railed walkway that completely encircled it. Nothing moved in front of them or above them. The companions passed cell doors ajar. Inside the barred cages directly opposite the doorway, prisoners or lackeys lay dead on the floor, either blown apart by the blast or chilled by flying shrap. Some of them had daggers of metal sticking out of their torsos and heads. Then, the live ones showed up. Dozens of minor demons and toadies burst from the cells in front of them and charged through the smoke. They waved their arms, male and female, half naked, their faces horror shows of botched surgeries and rictus grins, bleeding from eyes, ears, and noses. They were short of stature, carried no firearms, but they made up for that in sheer numbers and kill frenzy. Tom unslung his backpack and pitched a few primed and prepped plastic charges into the empty cells. Across the corridor, Ryan was doing the same thing to the cages opposite. Then both men reshouldered their packs and picked up their RPDs and continued on with the rest of the companions alert for any more attackers. Ryan saw the partially open door up ahead.
Better check in there. Blasters off!
He kicked the door back and entered with Tom right on his heels. The windowless room was deserted, but it wasn't empty. There were beds, a sink, a flush toilet, countertops, and it was crammed with stuff. At one end of a table, cluttered with other objects on an open blanket, lay an assortment of weapons. Familiar weapons. A scoped long blaster, a Sig Sauer pistol, a pump-action 12-gauge, revolvers, and an antique blaster. Doc made a beeline for his Civil War treasure. He pulled out the Lamat and checked the nipples and wadding.
Just the way I left it.
He strapped the holstered weapon around his waist. The others hurriedly reclaimed their hardware.
What is this room?
Maybe a warden's or a guard's quarters back in the day.
Have a look at this.
Christy waved the others over to the overloaded counter along one wall. In an array of covered plastic containers, there were pastes. Brown, green, gold, and yellow. She popped one of the lids.
Oh, Gaia! Oh, That is just awful.
What is it?
I have no clue, but if smells could kill...
This notebook is interesting, too. Perhaps you can make sense of it, Mildred. It is beyond me.
Tom looked over Mildred's shoulder as she flipped through the pages. He had never seen anything like it.
Could be Sanskrit.
Chicken scratching, you mean?
Look at these hand-drawn schematics. They look like chemical formulas. But there are symbols here for elements that don't exist, or at least I've never heard of.
Maybe it's a kid's game.
No kids here.
The symbology is too consistent for it to be something like that. Some of it almost makes sense mathematically. If this is biochem, it's not like anything I ever learned.
Where did it come from?
Your guess is as good as mine.
Who knows and who cares? If none of us can read it, it might as well be flies on dog shit.
I think we're ready to blow this dump to hell.
Not quite yet. First, we've got to destroy the Freezies who haven't been reanimated. As long as they can be resurrected, so can the plague weapon.
Blow them up, too.
Not necessary. All we have to do is pull the plugs on their cryo tanks and they'll start to thaw out. Without a computer regulating the defrosting, their bodies will turn to icy slunk and then rot in the heat.
Though the grounds were still crawling with terrified but smiling bootlicks, they found the entrance to the cold house unguarded. Tom, the companions, and Chucho just walked in and made themselves at home. Along the back wall was a row of stainless steel cylinders, practically floor to ceiling high and twice as wide as 55-gallon drums, each with its own set of LCD readout monitors and massive armored power conduits. JB frowned.
Mildred, I don't see any red blasted plugs to pull.
Then how about this?
She walked down the line of tanks, firing bursts from her 9mm subgun point blank into the front of each of them, emptying the 30-round stick mag. Before he backed out, Tom tossed down the last of the blocks of C4.
We need to put some distance between us and the C4 before I detonate. When this goes off, it's going to be a big bang.
We can't go out the way we came in. That's where the dog packs are coming from. We gotta go out the front gate.
Trouble is, the boat that brung us is the other way.
The boats that brought us are tied up at the end of the path that leads to the front gate.
Big enough to carry all of us?
Yes.
Problem solved, then. Let's get out of here.
When the gunfire started outside, Daniel DeCipio lay on his back on a gurney in the Razor House recovery room. Because he was still in terrible pain from the marrow suck, the white coats hadn't bothered to strap him down. After all, he could hardly walk, so how could he run? And where would he run?
Christy! Mildred! JP! Doc! Jack! Where are you?
He recognized the voice at once, and his blood ran cold. By now, Ryan Cotter should have been dead and wormy. Instead, he was calling out to his friends. He had come to rescue them. And perhaps he was already too late.
Holy fuck! He's gonna find me!
As doors banged back down the hallway, he managed to roll off the gurney. But in the process, he knocked over a rolling tray of surgical instruments that rained to the floor. When he hit the floor, a white-hot pain exploded in his hips. He had to assume that Cotter and whoever was with him would search room to room, chilling the white coats as they went. He knew he'd get no mercy either. From the sound of it, they were coming his way. Hand over hand, dragging his legs behind him, he crawled on his belly to the nearest cover, beneath the stainless steel operating table. When the door opened, it wasn't the one-eyed man who appeared. It was Dr. Yorte. The head white coat rushed in and quickly closed the door behind him. His eyes were wide with fear as he swept his fingers through his thick black hair again and again. Dr. Yorte was far too preoccupied to notice that his plague vector was gone from the gurney. Daniel recalled the words spoken earlier as he had writhed under the corkscrewing needle.
Maybe we should suck the cells from his spine. Oh no, wait a minute. I forgot. He doesn't have one.
Waves of pain shot down his legs and blurred his mind, jumbling the memories of his 135-year life. The distinction between the plastic surgeon and his pre-dark publisher vanished. They became one and the same, a single object of hatred and loathing. A fixture of his existence. Meanwhile, Dr. Yorte had crossed the room and dropped to his hands and knees in front of a low cabinet built into the back wall. He opened the little cabinet door, pushed aside the contents, then squeezed himself inside and pulled the door shut behind him. Daniel lay there, listening with every muscle tensed while the fighting escalated. He closed his eyes and kept them closed for what seemed like a very long time until the shooting stopped. Under his nose, amid the scattering of gleaming surgical tools, was a scalpel, its edge keen as a razor. Almost of its own accord, his hand moved to grab it. The feel of the steel handle against his palm was electrifying. A terrible energy animated his limbs, driving out the pain in his hips. He squeezed the scalpel so hard his knuckles turned white. Then the epiphany hit. Before him was the opportunity he had been longing for. The time had finally come for him to write his own story. Rising shakily to his feet, the fire talker approached the cabinet.
No spine, huh?
He ripped open the cabinet, reached in, and snatched hold of Dr. Yorte by the hair. As he hauled the white coat out of the hidey hole, Daniel rammed his right knee into the middle of Yorte's face. Yorte went limp, stunned. Daniel dumped him onto his back, then straddled his chest, pinning his arms to the floor with his knees. Moving the scalpel back and forth in a frenzied attack, the firecocker slashed through white fabric and into the brown, hairless skin. Yorte, still horribly alive, was flapping his arms, smearing his blood, and making a red snow angel on the white-tiled floor. Bloody scalpel in his bloody hand, the fire talker stumbled from the room, down the hall, his paper hospital gown bearing his ass to the world. After two lifetimes of subjugation, of humiliation, he was finally victorious. He had started his own story at last. He had cast himself as the indomitable pulp hero. There were no pages of space-filling dialogue, no interminable backstory explanations that never quite made sense. This was the real deal. Daniel DeCipio had become an avenging angel of the perpetually downtrodden, the victimized, but he wasn't done yet. There still had to be an ending, a shocking but appropriate climax. He owed that kind of finish to his audience, even if it was an audience of one. Daniel staggered out of the building, then across the yard to the door of Jaguar House. Imprisoned in the dark, starved, taunted, furious, they would be the instruments of his vengeance on the criminal monsters still roaming the compound. Having finally discovered his spine, Daniel found to his surprise that he couldn't undiscover it. He knew he was just as much of a beast as those he was about to destroy, and his crimes were much more subtle than the machete chop and the shotgun blast. They were cowardly, backstabbing crimes of mass murder against the innocent and the helpless. He knew that for justice to be done, he too had to be punished. At last, Daniel DeCipio was the author of something truly original, his lifelong dream come true. Throwing aside the scalpel, he hurled open the door to Jaguar House. The dogs were on him in an instant, pulling him down onto the courtyard, biting into him, shaking their massive heads, tearing out his flesh in great chunks. Ryan hustled the others out the prison's front gate ahead of him. He backed out of Shivalba, looking down the sights of his RPD, covering the retreat. Figures were running around between the buildings, but no one was coming after them. Harmonica Tom stopped 50 feet down the path, shrugged out of his pack, and then dug around in it for the remote detonator. Holding it up for the others to see, he flipped off the safety switch.
Any last words for these bastards?
Fuck them. Do it.
Fire in the hole.
Even in daylight, the flash through the trees was blinding, and the cluster of C4 booms so tightly spaced, they seemed almost simultaneous. It was the kind of explosion that nothing could survive. Debris began to rain down, falling through the forest canopy.
We're too close! We need to move!
As they hurried down the path, Ryan envisioned the destruction in his mind's eye. The site cratered, leveled, littered with pieces of concrete. When he turned his head, he saw Chucho was watching his expression and smiling like a proud pappy. The other hero twin was thinking the same thing he was. Absolute nuke and wipeout. As Adapul crashed through the rainforest, his heavy footfalls jarred the mask that still covered his head. The terrible explosions had made the very hillsides shake. Running away from the fight held no shame for him. He had nothing important vested in the effort, nor had any of the others. The creatures who lived as long as they did, the fictions of Shivalba and the Lords of Death, were simply entertaining diversions while they waited for rescue. The jungle felt like home to him, not because he had lived here for more than three quarters of a century, but because it reminded him of his real home, far, far away. The deep shade, the constant heat and humidity, the high oxygen content, the profusion of edibles from which dietary pastes could be made. The EM pulse of Nuke Day had been the beacon that had lured Autopool 10 and his crew to Earth from deep space. During the planetary survey, the unthinkable happened. The mothership had malfunctioned, fallen out of orbit, and crashed. Lucky for the surviving crew of the survey shuttle, they had been mapping the island as a possible habitation site for a future colonist base. It was easily defensible, with natural barriers to invasion. The Lords of Death had never once left Shabalba because, not being human, they didn't recognize its squalor. They were satisfied by the prison and the surrounding jungle. They needed to be close to the shuttle when help finally arrived. The initial takeover of the prison from the Marachin had been easy. The pirates were a superstitious and ignorant lot. Their leaders were deranged maniacs. The Mayan mythos, coupled with a show of advanced weaponry, quickly brought them to heel. Autopool 10 and his crew understood the use of plague weapons, and after the initial debacle in Panama City, had designed a campaign of conquest around them. To survive the centuries until their distress signal was answered, they had to acquire a steady supply of goods and services. In a nuke-blasted world, this required an empire of sorts. Cargo ships traveling back and forth from the north, pack trains crossing the isthmus. A primitive, extractive bureaucracy. At the first sign of trouble that afternoon, he and the other five members of his crew had scattered off into the jungle, according to plan, soon to regroup at their shuttle landing site. Something moved on the trail ahead of him. Something gray, slinking low and fast between the trees. Four legs. Autopool 10 slowed to a walk. Then, he could see them. All around him, the feral dogs closed in. Their coats wet, their ears pinned back. He saw their eyes, their bared teeth, their dripping maws. He saw their hot breath gusting out like steam. There were dozens of them, none smaller than 80 pounds, some half again that large. Creatures who loved to kill, who killed each other out of boredom. Culling the weak was their recreation. Autopool 10 was not weak. He reached up and unfastened the clamps that held down his mask. When he removed it, the animals froze, either from the sight or the smell of him. Then he opened the hideous orifice that passed for a mouth. The hell dogs dropped to their stomachs. As he strode past them, some rolled onto their backs and presented their bellies to him, the alpha of alphas. Others slinked away into the jungle, tails between their legs. There was no telling how much longer rescue would take, Autopool 10 thought, as he refastened his mask. He resumed his jog to the rendezvous at the downed shuttle. With the plague weapon destroyed, Tierra de la Muerte was out of reach, temporarily. He always enjoyed a challenge. It helped pass the time. And time was what he and the others had on their side. The off-key music coming from the Bertram's flybridge made Ryan wince and look up. Tom was teaching Chucho how to play the harmonica as he closed in on the anchored 45-foot Hatteras. It was a shame and a pity to destroy such a fine and rare ship, but the alternative, running it back to Panama City, was pointless. Ryan knew they'd just have to sink it there. They had already destroyed the boats at the island's other landing site. The idea was to cut it off from the mainland. Permanently, if possible. Ryan figured that when word got back to Veracruz and the other Mexican city-states that there was no more threat of plague and the Lords of Death were out of business, the Red Sashes and priests were going to be in big trouble. Their empire would crumble in a matter of days, and it would be real heads on sticks leading the parades. When Tom had the Bertram in position in the cove, Ryan and JB hefted RPDs and aimed close-range machine guns at the full length of the Hatteras's waterline. 200 rounds turned the fiberglass hull to splinter and made it leak like a sieve. The ship almost immediately began to list hard to port. They watched until it settled to the bottom. The water wasn't deep enough to entirely submerge it. The flybridge and radar mast were still visible above the surface. Tom carefully backed the Bertram out of the cove, and Chucho brought the harmonica back to his lips. Doc was so moved by the serenade that he broke into an ungainly impromptu jig on the stern deck. The scarecrow dance made Mildred, JB, and Jack grin.
Dance, old man!
As Ryan turned to watch the time traveler's perilous footwork, out of the corner of his eye, he thought he saw something move on the beach near the cave mouth. Something white, on two legs, with a big old head. But when he looked back, the beach was empty. Noting the concern on his face, Christy stepped closer. He slipped an arm around her narrow waist.
What is it, lover?
Nothing. It's nothing. This rad-blasted place has got me seeing things.
Deathlands Dark Resurrection is a graphic audio production. Deathlands and all characters are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2009, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Narrated by Thomas Penny. Performed by Richard Rowan, Terrence Aselford, Dolores King-Williams, Colleen Delaney, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, Andy Clemens, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Lily Beacon, Nathan Bennett, Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Ken Jackson, Christopher Grayville, and Jonathan Watkins. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Ken Jackson. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing by Johann Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler, Greg Reinfeld, and Brian Rogers. Adapted for graphic audio by Cheryl Hayes. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders and Earthblood, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for a preview of another graphic audio title.
Giants. Including the biggest and ugliest of those big and ugly brutes I have ever seen. Iron Deck is called. And even the Powries, even Koskosio Begulin himself, gives him great respect. His armor is special, I fear, perhaps even magical, for it seems almost to have an inner fire.
Feel me! This is only one human! One puny human! 100 pieces of king's gold! And 10 prisoners to the one that brings me the head of Nightbird!
You believe this to be a game? Tell me where she is!
You're a wretch! You're calling yourselves men of God, but no good God would approve of your works. You took from me, you thieving wretch, and for that I'll see you pay!
Who's there?
You knew we would come for you.
Your Markwart is an evil man. I call on you now, in the name of the solemn vow of our order, piety, dignity, poverty, to turn against this evil course, to find again the light.
Don't miss Demon Wars Saga Book 2, The Demon Spirit Part 2. Available now from Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net.